You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across North America, all across the continent, on Pacific stations across the North America, all over North America, Europe, and Africa. American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several other cable systems via the Free Speech TV Network. Welcome to our program. The Republican convention is kind of sputtering along. And meanwhile, New Orleans is a little concerned. And let me take a different route into this story than the usual one. On this day, today, August 28th, 49 years ago, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King gave his most famous speech, telling 300,000 Americans who showed up for that speech, huddled together at the Lincoln Memorial here in Washington, D.C., that he had a dream. Here's a clip from it.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
Yes.
It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
Yes.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal.
Yes.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream.
There you go. 49 years later, today, on this day, Republicans are meeting in Tampa, Florida, to turn the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's dream back into the nightmare of inequality and segregation that he had lived through. Dr. King had a dream that one day this nation would rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed, you know, of our founding words, of the stuff that's in the Declaration and the original idealistic, wasn't played out all that well, but it was there. Our creed that all people are created equal. He had a dream that the sweltering heat of oppression would transform into an oasis of freedom and justice. He had a dream that in southern states where races held power, one day little black children and little white children would join hands as sisters and brothers. In the decades since Dr. King's speech, this nation has worked hard to make King's dream a reality and succeeded in many ways, although there's still a lot of work to do. But today, Dr. King's dream is in danger like never before. Today, we have a Republican Party that's actually trying to overturn the Voting Rights Act of 1965, a significant achievement from Dr. King's era that outlawed black voter suppression through things like poll taxes and literacy tests. We have more than a half dozen state attorneys general, all from states with a long history of denying minorities the vote, petitioning the Supreme Court to strike down the Voting Rights Act and let Republican state legislatures pass the American Legislative Exchange Council, you know, the Koch brothers funded things, these radical voter suppression ID laws that could kick one in four African Americans off the voting rolls in November. We have a Republican Party that will rely and is relying on race baiting and dog whistle politics to question the legitimacy of our nation's first African-American president. You'll hear from the birthers. You'll hear from those who refer to Obama as the food stamp president. You'll hear the word welfare used again and again and again in Karl Rove's advertisements. And you'll hear calls for states' rights, that coded phrase used to justify decades of racism and oppression before and during King's era. But King didn't just have a dream about racial equality. Reverend Martin Luther King had a dream about economic equality as well. He was assassinated in Memphis while supporting the striking sanitation workers' union. He told them, you are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages. I need not remind you that this is the plight of our people all over America. Now our struggle is for genuine equality, which means economic equality. And yet today, unions have been decimated. The gap between workers and CEOs is larger than ever, and wealth inequality in America is at levels unseen even before King's time. At the RNC, politicians are going to be applauded for their war on organized labor. Scott Walker's a deity in Tampa for taking on the public sector unions. Chris Christie earned a keynote speaking gig for taking on the teachers union. In King's era, nearly a third of the American workforce was unionized. Today, it's about a tenth. Thanks to those very same people who are speaking tonight at the Republican convention and over the next few days in Tampa, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's dream for economic equality is becoming a nightmare. The middle class is being destroyed. And as his dream for world peace is also being destroyed. Beyond racial and economic equality, King dreamed of peace. He said in New York City in 1967 in a speech against the Vietnam War, "The oceans of history are made turbulent by the ever-rising tides of hate. History is cluttered with the wreckage of nations and individuals that pursued the self-defeating path of hate. We still have a choice today, nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation. We must move past indecision to action. We must find new ways to speak for peace in Vietnam and justice throughout the developing world, a world that borders on our doors." Still quoting here from Dr. King. "If we do not act, we shall surely be dragged down the long, dark, and shameful corridors of time, reserved for those who possess power without compassion, might without morality, and strength without sight." End of quote. Today we're in a never-ending war on terror, promoted by those same people that you're going to hear in Tampa, Florida. In fact, the one voice in the Republican Party who aligns with Dr. King in opposition to war, Ron Paul, he's been banned from speaking at the convention. Instead, he's been replaced by people like Rick Santorum, who want even more war, who believe America's army is God's army and should bring democracy to the Middle East through drone strikes, cruise missiles, cluster bombs. You know, we're already too far down those long, dark, shameful corridors that those nations that possess power without compassion have walked in the past. Dr. King's dream of peace is a nightmare tonight in Tampa, Florida. And so on this night, nearly a half century after King talked about his dream, we should all be aware of the choice in front of us. It's a choice that frankly couldn't be any clearer. On one side, we have the dream or nightmare coming from the RNC, a dream that only the wealthy can be trusted, that minorities are flawed, and that endless war is destined by God. And on the other side, we have the American dream. A dream rooted in equality, economic justice, and lasting peace. A dream handed down to us by Dr. Martin Luther King, and a dream that our nation can and will achieve if we just all work at it and don't give in to the politics of division that we hear coming out of Tampa. You know, the stakes couldn't be higher. There is an actual concerted effort to destroy the middle class of America because the middle class, we are no longer useful to the international oligarchs. Thomas Friedman, the world is flat. It is now a world run by multinational corporations that don't give a damn about individual countries or people. And they certainly don't want a middle class. There is no nation in the world that has ever built a middle class without government involvement. And the Republicans are going to be arguing for just the opposite. You just watch.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with guests from the Republican National Convention. It should be entertaining. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my, the RNC is happening. Hurricane Katrina is, the ghost of Katrina is heading toward New Orleans on the anniversary of Katrina. That's downright spooky. Kind of makes you wonder where Brownie is. Oh, that's right. He's doing a radio show in Denver with David Sirota. That's got to be fascinating. Amazing. Is Frank on the line with us? He is? Yes? No, maybe? Frank Donatelli, are you there?
Tom, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I am. Yes, I can. And welcome to
How
our program.
How are you? You good
are
to
the,
be with you.
You are the chairman of GOPAC, the GOP Political Action Committee. Is that GOPAC.org? Is that an accurate description?
It's more of an acronym, GOPAC. But we are the group that finds and trains and educates the next generation of Republican leaders, people that run for state legislature, state and local office. Mm-hmm. And eventually, in a few years, they move on and run for Congress and Senate and maybe even president someday.
How do you get these young people to believe that things like, you know, free college education like we used to have in the United States that Jefferson and Lincoln did, Lincoln with land-grant colleges, Jefferson with the UVA, the GI Bill, that those are bad things and that, you know, corporate CEOs should be making a fortune off their education and they should have big student loans. How do you convince them to think like Republicans?
Well, I don't know that it's that difficult. I mean, I think that our message of economic opportunity and upward mobility is something that should appeal to all segments if we develop it properly. We have not done a good job with young people, if you're going to look at the results of the last couple presidential elections.
Yeah.
So we have a ways to go there.
Do you think it could be your message? I mean, for example, what I just said?
I think the message of economic opportunity is something that should resonate with young people.
Well, what does that mean? Genuinely, Frank. I mean, what you say economic opportunity.
I thought it was self-evident what it meant. It meant that if you graduate and do a good job in college, you can find a good job. And that means that the government should develop good policy so that there are jobs available to young people when they leave the school and go into the workforce.
So GOPAC thinks that there should be more government involvement in this developing policies so that people can find jobs.
You're supposed to develop policies that create the right framework so the private sector can create jobs. Yes, government doesn't create jobs.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I mean, government does create some jobs, obviously. Paul Ryan works for the government, for example. But, government is like the soil in which the plants of private enterprise, free enterprise businesses can grow. And
the government should tend to the soil.
Yeah,
the government
puts the
nutrients
in there. I'm surprised to hear you say that, though, because I keep hearing Republicans say, "Get rid of government, get rid of government, get rid of government." And
now,
here
come on,
you are,
now, come on,
you know,
Tom,
the chairman
who says
of the
GOPAC
saying,
"Tom, now come on." Beside Ron Paul, who else says that?
Well, you know, Ronald Reagan did in his inaugural address. He said, "Government is not the problem; it's just the problem."
Ronald Reagan never said, "Get rid of government." Ronald Reagan said, "Government too often is the problem; it's not the solution." And it's the problem when it gets too big, and it tries to compete with the private sector rather than stimulating the private sector.
When has that ever happened in the United States?
Now.
In what area is the government competing with the private sector?
They run General Motors now.
The General Motors is run by its own board of directors at this moment.
And with the active involvement of the federal government.
Until the money is paid back.
Who forgave a lot of loans and screwed the bondholders so that Obama could reward his union friends.
But there are a lot of banks that hold large chunks of assets of a lot of companies in America that in exchange for that took a seat on the board of directors and have some control over it. I mean, that's not an unusual thing. In fact, you would expect that. If you're gonna bail a company out, you want to have some say in how it's working.
Of course.
That's not the government competing against private enterprise, unless the private enterprise you're talking about is BMW in Germany or Toyota in Japan. And if so, what is bad about that?
Government should never dictate. Government should never be in a position where they can dictate private decisions of private companies. What you just described is exactly why General Motors probably is not going to be competitive for the long term.
Are you suggesting that government should not be involved in things like saying to a private company, you know, we're not going to give you all the privileges that go along with incorporation, you know, limited liability and tax breaks and all these other things. We're not going to give you that if you hire kids who are, 10 years old, child labor.
The private sector has to obey all the laws that the government passes.
So you do think that the government should define the playing field?
Of course. Stop setting up this straw man. Private companies pay taxes. They can't discriminate based on race. Those are all very, very good things. I'm just saying, from a practical viewpoint.
But there are people in your party who don't think those are good things.
Well, who are they? You keep saying there are such people. It's
all
not
these guys,
Paul
I
Ryan.
Keep hearing. You know, I keep hearing these guys yell about states' rights and too much.
You listen to Obama too much.
No,
I mean, that's what Obama and Biden.
I think maybe I'm listening to
right wing
talk radio too much,
say.
But. You know, it's refreshing to hear somebody, a Republican, who's sounding more like Dwight Eisenhower and less like, Rush Limbaugh, frankly.
Well, I like feel like sound like Ronald Reagan. I mean, because he's still the lodestar of our party, and it's
kind of sad. I mean, he tripled the national debt. You really think that's honorable?
He got us out of a very bad economic mess. He ended the Cold War.
He created an economic mess.
And he made America feel better. Look, I'll put Reagan's record against Obama's any day. Would you take me up on that bet?
I certainly would.
Obama's policies are miserable. Obama has given us more debt than all 43 presidents. Did you know that? That he's on pace to create more debt?
And it was three Republican presidents who set that up. But, you know, Frank... Hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Frank Donatelli, the chairman of GoPac. GoPac.org is the website. Frank, thanks for a reasonable conversation. Dreaming of a middle class in America. Not exactly what's happening at the Republican National Convention. They're dreaming about 26 billionaires, 26 rich white guys who are going to largely fund the entire Republican Party. Shelley Adelson, one of them, has come out and said, oh, yeah, Shmuley Boutique, he's a good guy. I know Shmuley. He and I have debated many times. He's an Orthodox rabbi in New Jersey and a decent human being. If, set aside his crazed right-wing politics. And so Adelson says, yeah, I'll throw $500,000 into your campaign, and poof, you're a congressman. Is this America? I mean, when they do this kind of thing in other countries, where the oligarchs basically decide who's going to run and the oligarchs fund the elections, we call them oligarchies. We don't call them democracies. We don't call them even republics. Is this America? It's incredible. Dave, in Melbourne, Florida, your thoughts on this?
Hey, the first guy that you were talking to, I don't know where he's coming from. You had, you got Grover Norquist said he wants to be able to tie government up and throw it in the bathroom and put a hood over its head.
His exact phrase to Mara Liasson on NPR about back in 2002 was he wants to shrink government to the size where he can drown it in the bathtub.
Yeah, exactly. You have Chris Christie, who's open contempt for Democrats. He's been on tape at the Koch meeting saying that what he wants to, he doesn't want to go down the hall and speak to those people who are the Democrats, but he'll get in a private helicopter and fly over to speak to the Koch brothers at their, at their penthouse office. I mean,
yep.
I don't know where this guy's coming from. They want to kill the Department of Education. You got Bachman says she wants to do away with the EPA. Several of those kooks up there have talked about destroying the Department of Education. They're all about just taking away everything that makes the middle class, that enables the middle class to function.
I know that. And what I found fascinating, I mean, here's the guy, Frank Donatelli, he's the chairman of GOPAC, their big political action committee, and I was expecting him to, go right-wing crazy on me, like they usually do. And instead, he tried sounding like a rational guy. Now, the question is he a rational guy or is this the new strategy? I would argue that it's probably that this is the new strategy, and that Frank was being somewhat disingenuous in his attempts to debate me and his arguments with me. But
I hate to equate them to the white supremacists, but the white supremacists, also, they put out a, you know, an edict that when you go out, don't talk white supremacy, you know, dress up nice and start to ease people into it. You know, I mean,
yeah.
It's similar. It's a similar it's a similar approach. And what I think we're going to see tonight is a lot of people talking about how good it is to be inside this room here with all the dummies out there, and we know best. And, you know, if you want to see what a Romney presidency looks like, go to Tampa and see the guards that are keeping people, you know, 5 and 6 blocks from even their shouts approaching anybody walking in inside the.
We had Medea Benjamin on our TV show last night. We should get her on the radio show. She had a pretty. In fact, we're going to have another report tonight from outside the convention as well. There's a lot going on out there, and you're absolutely right, Dave. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening on Sirius. Tom, listening on KTNF in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, welcome back. Glad
Thank
to hear you.
You
getting through your ordeal there.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome back. Hey, just that guest you just had, the chairman of GOPAC, I thought you had him when he said Reagan is our Lone Star symbol and wanted to compare Reagan to Obama, and he kind of stumped you there for a little bit. But what we should do, what they want to do is compare 20th century records. Why don't we compare Reagan to Franklin Roosevelt? And you know the story there, where Reagan took us from a creditor nation to a debtor nation, and FDR saved us from the first Republican Great Depression. And then move into the 21st century, and I thought you were going to say, well, let's compare Obama to Bush Jr., no contest there. Or let's compare Clinton to Papa Bush, no contest there. Or let's compare Kennedy to Nixon. I mean, so if they want to put Reagan, I'm hoping the Democrats put FDR and invoke his legacy.
Well, and I was running out of time, so those kinds of debates at any length really wouldn't be all that possible.
I was throwing all kinds of nonsense.
Yeah, I was most curious about what he had to say, and also I wanted to let my listeners hear what he had to say so that you'd have some sense of, you know, where the Republicans are going with all this stuff. I have a lot of faith in the intelligence of our listeners.
I mean, we got to keep bringing up Bush Jr. They keep trying to bring up Reagan. Well, let's bring up Roosevelt. You want to, you know, bring up Obama? Let's compare it to Bush Jr.
Yeah. You know, well said. And but it looks to me like their strategy is going to be to try to turn Mitt Romney into Ronald Reagan, and or at least that seems to be kind of a subtext of what he was saying. And if they're going to do that, I mean, Reagan was a chameleon, you know, he did change.
What my thinking is, and you, I'm sure you agree with this, if they want to keep invoking this mythology of Reagan, Obama, since his what he inherited is similar to what Roosevelt inherited, we should invoke that legacy and say, no, we want to go back to those prosperous times and try to use that connection. If they want to keep putting up Reagan, we should bring up Roosevelt.
Yeah. Or at the very least, the surplus.
If they want to make Romney Reagan, okay, Obama's Roosevelt. And let's compare let the media start researching the records, and you'll find that we win.
Yeah, or at the very least, we could be talking about, there's a whole long list of them. Tom, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. John, in Minneapolis, also listening on KTNF. Hey, John, what's up?
Yes, I just wanted to point out this morning I had heard a report about a company that was bought out by Bain Capital in Freeport, Illinois.
Sensata.
Owned by Honeywell, and they're offshoring these jobs over to China, and these people are some of the employees are trying to get in touch with Mitt Romney to see if they can't keep these jobs in Freeport, Illinois. These are highly trained people, and now they're forced to train their replacements who are Chinese. And they have gone to the Republican convention, and they were shouted down as being communist, and it's really ironic because here the company is going to be going to a communist country. So
right.
I guess Mitt Romney prefers to do business in a communist country rather than here in the United States. And it's just a tragedy. I mean,
right.
It's terrible. It's all about greed because the company is making money It's just not that they're not making, you know, 400 or 500%. They're making probably about 150%.
Yeah, and this company is Sensata or Sensata Technologies, and we had a member of their, they don't have a union. We had one of their representatives here on the show before I had this whole surgical debacle, and you know, talked about it considerably. We will bring the subject back over and over again, I promise you. It is such a classic example of Republican extremism. I mean, it just blows my mind. And
can I make one more comment?
If it's very quick.
Yes. I also went to a public lecture by William Grider. He wrote for the Washington Post.
Yeah, I know him.
And people in the Bush administration had admitted that they wanted to shrink the middle class. And this was over 10 or 12 years ago. This was before the financial meltdown of 2008. So they've succeeded in doing that. So we should applaud them, you know, and also other Republicans who have also conspired to do the same.
Yeah, I'm with you. Thanks a lot for the comment. Sharon, and listening on KBAI in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Sharon, what's up?
Hi. I've already called Maria Cantwell's office, who I plan to call back, Rick Larson, Patty Murray. But I need a suggestion from you.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way that I can suggest or that's feasible to put an end forever to this voter suppression stuff that's going on? Is it constitutional? Is it what? Is there a way to get us more like Australia, which I learned from you, that you have to vote down there?
Right. 98% compliance.
What suggestions can I make to these people?
It's a tough one. I mean, there's more than a half a dozen different places in the Constitution where it says or implies that we have a right to vote. And yet the Supreme Court, in their Bush v. Gore decision, came out and explicitly said there is no specifically enumerated right to vote in the Constitution. 5-4 decision, but the Supreme Court said that. So as of right now, the law of the land is that you and I do not have a right to vote. We have a privilege to vote, and states can take that privilege away from us based on whatever criteria they want, as long as that criteria isn't racial or there's a few things that are protected by the Voter Rights Act. And, of course, the Republicans want to do away with the Voter Rights Act now, to do away with even that. So in my opinion, frankly, what we need is for a Supreme Court to, setting aside my opposition to judicial review, for a Supreme Court to look at this situation and say, yes, when the Constitution talked about the right of women to vote, when the Constitution talks about the right of African Americans in the 20th Amendment, in the 14th Amendment, when it talks, or 13th Amendment, when it talks about the right of African Americans to vote, when it refers to the right to vote throughout the Constitution, it's referring to an actual right. And if we can't get that, then we should probably try to get legislation or constitutional amendment that specifically says we have a right to vote. And then you would have to have enabling legislation that facilitates that right to vote, and that right to vote should not involve private for-profit corporations counting our vote for us with these voting machines. So it's going to be a long haul, Sharon.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And by the way, if you want to have a Supreme Court that is going to make that kind of decision, you're not going to get one appointed by Mitt Romney. It's vital to have another 4 years of Barack Obama.
I'm working on a dream. I'm working on a dream.
Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Chuck Woolery with GenerationAmerica.org, a conservative group for seniors, is on the line live from the RNC, brought to us via the Talk Radio News Services facilities. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you, buddy?
I'm great.
I'm actually afraid to be on television like this. It makes you look fat, old, and everything I am. I can't disguise anything.
We all get there, right? Hey, how can you, a conservative group for seniors seems to me like an oxymoron when Paul Ryan wants to convert Medicare into a voucher program, and you got a lot of conservatives who are running around saying, let's give Social Security to Wall Street. How do you sell this stuff?
That's not what I'm really about. I'm about no more Obamacare. Medicare is like a whole different situation. That's advocating for the seniors. Here's what I do believe, okay, that may fall into the category or the slot that you just picked to talk about, and that is if government is involved in Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, or anything else, if whatever they're involved in, it's inefficient and
not
it
true.
Costs more.
Not true.
Okay,
Medicare's overhead is
3%.
United Healthcare pays their CEO over $1.4 billion. Medicare pays their employees $60,000-$70,000 a year. Their overhead is 3%. United Healthcare, 30% to 40% they've made as overhead. I mean, you look at
so
these,
what are you picking out an insurance company and using that as an example?
Any of the insurance companies
for government?
Pick any insurance company.
Okay,
none of them are operating at 3%.
Okay, fine. But is Medicare solvent, and is it going to be solvent, staying at where it is today? Or are we going to be solvent? Are we fine?
Well, Obamacare extended its lifetime as everything is right now for another 8 years.
You can't believe this stuff, Tom.
This is the CBO. This is not a.
I know what the CBO
political
said.
Faction.
The CBO also said that AARP will make $1 billion over 10 years off of Obamacare.
Well, they're making far more than that right now. You know, AARP is the front group for United Healthcare, which is one of the reasons I mentioned them. I mean, they're
okay,
and this is because Republicans keep drilling holes in Medicare saying, hey, let's have a private corporation come in and fill those holes.
You know what? I'm not saying that government is the answer to anything. I'm really not, whether it's Republican establishment or Democrat establishment.
You're opposed to the Army?
I said whether it's Republican establishment or Democrat establishment. Don't take me off course. You know as well as I do that the Army is part of the Constitution and should be there. I understand that. But I'm talking about government getting into our private lives with health care, Social Security is a great example of something.
You're arguing that the government should not be telling women that they should be forced to carry a pregnancy if they've been raped.
I don't think the government should tell them anything. I don't think Republicans should be legislating morality, and I don't think the Democrats should be legislating equality.
You're going to be in deep trouble with your party.
I don't care. That's what I think. I'm not my party. I'm a conservative libertarian. So what I have in common with my party is they're closest to my views, but I don't agree with their establishment at all. I think they're all political hacks who are trying to stay in business and make as much money and keep their power as long as they possibly can. But that's what I think about all of government, from the municipal right on up to the federal government.
Okay, so
that's a problem that we have to solve.
If
However,
you're a libertarian, can you name for me one country in the history of the world that has ever produced a middle class using libertarian principles?
No, I cannot, because the United States is the only place close to that who has produced a middle class, and they were basically libertarian
and our
conservative.
Middle class was produced
Let me finish. Libertarian conservative. Look, let's go back to Washington. Although this may be painful.
Why don't you go back to Eisenhower? That's when the middle class started.
No, because Washington is better. Let's go back to Washington. Eisenhower was a general, not a politician, not a very good one. But let's go back to Washington. Washington described government this way. He said, government is not reason. Government is not eloquent. Government is force. It's like fire. It's a dangerous servant and a fearful master. And, Tom, I believe today we're at the fearful master stage of that analogy.
Well, and George Washington was also
the first servant.
And George Washington was also the first president of the United States to sign legislation providing for care for medical care, food, and housing for the poor. He signed the first welfare legislation in the history of the United States.
And?
So, but we were talking about the middle class, and I'm still baffled how a libertarian can say that.
Wait a minute. Well, hold on. You keep calling me a libertarian.
Well,
like
you said
I'm
you
Ron
were.
Paul. No, I said I was a libertarian conservative.
What does that mean?
Well, I don't like everything the libertarians say, and I don't.
Able to smoke dope. Is that your?
I don't think it's the government's business. If people want to smoke dope, that's their problem.
Okay, so what is it that you disagree with libertarians about?
I don't know. I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here to talk about Generation America. We can have that conversation some other time.
Okay. Well, I'm curious. I'm eternally curious.
You're way too curious, Tom.
Okay. We're talking with Chuck Woolery with GenerationAmerica.org, a conservative group for seniors. Advocating for seniors. What is it? What's your sales pitch?
Well, it's not really
your
a sales pitch.
Speech.
It's not a sales pitch because I'm not selling Generation America. I'm trying to expose people to it.
Sure.
Look,
I didn't mean that as a negative.
The point is, people say, are you running for something? I'm not running for anything.
Sure.
I'm just trying to advocate for what I feel is the truth.
Well,
and what
what's your message for the seniors who are watching right now who might want to go to GenerationAmerica.org?
Right.
We just have a minute left, Chuck.
Okay.
What do you want to say to them?
Well, I think that if they understand AARP is a left-leaning group, who will make $1 billion over the next 10 years over Obamacare, and they're happy with that, then that's where they should stay. If they're unhappy with that and they want someone to advocate for them in Washington using a more conservative approach, then they should come to Generation America.
Okay, so you're competing with AARP.
You asked me to finish. Offers the same services at a lower price.
Okay.
When I say lower price, insurance, things like that are...
I'll be the first to say, Chuck, I'm no fan of AARP. They're a front
group.
They're basically insurance salespeople. They're a front group for largely United Healthcare, they've been making billions of dollars before. Obama cut the amount of money that they're getting, in Obamacare. If you do away with Obamacare, AARP is going to make even more money.
Yeah, it doesn't matter because they're going to have that Medigap where they'll just make so much money it's unbelievable.
You're absolutely right. And it was Republicans who put it in place. And
Generation America will do that too, but we're advocating against Obamacare, not for it. So I think it's the best thing for America, not necessarily the best thing for my company.
Okay, Chuck Woolery with GenerationAmerica.org, conservative group for seniors. Thanks a lot, Chuck.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you live in Washington, D.C. and live in Tampa, Florida at the Republican National Convention. Pete Hegseth, the president of Concerned Veterans for America. The website, oddly enough, is concernedveteransforamerica.org. And Pete, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. What are you guys concerned about?
We're concerned about the freedoms that we fought for overseas. You got generations of veterans that have gone overseas to fight for the precious freedoms we have, the liberties we have, we share here. And we want to make sure that when we come home, we're a part of the conversation.
Pete, if I could interrupt you for just a second.
Yeah.
You are really, really faint, and the noise is really, really loud. And you might want to ask the talk radio people, first of all, you need to have your mouth eating that microphone. And secondly, if they have a second microphone on for another guest, they might want to turn that one down. So let's start over again. You were saying.
Okay. Can you hear me better now?
No.
You can't hear me very well.
Yeah. Just get right up there.
Here we go.
I
had the wrong mic.
Oh, no wonder. Now I hear you just fine.
All right. You want me to start over, or how do you want to do it?
Yeah. Let's just start over.
Okay.
So what are you concerned about?
Oh, we're concerned about the freedoms here at home. It's always fragile. Nothing we have here is inevitable. Generations of men and women have gone overseas to fight for our freedoms, which are precious, the liberties we have, the free enterprise system we have here. And we look at the policies and things here in the United States, and we want to be a part of that policy and advocacy discussion and make sure that we're advancing the liberties we fought for here, expanding freedom, expanding our free enterprise system, growth and prosperity, and making sure that we're not subject to the kinds of decline that we've seen other nations like ours go through in history.
Are you concerned that the military is the victim of a hustle? For example, ExxonMobil uses our Navy to protect their shipping lines, and this is an expense that you and I pay through our taxes of tens of billions of dollars a year, and yet ExxonMobil pays no taxes at all in the United States.
Well, I don't know the details of ExxonMobil's
Well, they're not the only one. This is true of almost all of the oil companies.
Sure, but we have a global economy. We're a part of a global economy. We benefit from the trade we have across the country.
But shouldn't we care about the American economy first?
Oh, absolutely we do, and our exports are a pretty important part of that. And if we're not able to export our goods to other countries, then we're not able to maintain the kind of economy we have. And frankly, part of the problem is the rest of the world is sitting out. No one else in the world is capable of defending the seas, the sea lanes, other interests around the globe, other than the United States. We're it. So if we don't do it, Well, you know, whether it's regular crime. See, you can't just say for whom, because absent our presence, we don't know what those waters would truly look like. And because the United States is there providing that presence, we don't see the kind of whatever hijackings or disruptions in our commerce that you might otherwise see without a U.S. presence.
You are a genuine imperialist. I mean, you really believe that America should be an imperial force that is essentially the force that rules the world and keeps it safe.
I don't know that I would refer to myself as an imperialist. I do think we have interests abroad, and part of our military's job, in addition to protecting the homeland, is ensuring that our economic interests are protected around the globe as well.
What do you think about George Washington and his farewell address, where he said, you know, please avoid foreign entanglements, and the Monroe Doctrine?
But you can always go too far with one quote or two. I mean, should we have not been foreign entangled in World War II? There are entanglements we're inclined to be a part of because there are larger things to defend.
And, sure.
So it's not you can't just say a one-off. What we're trying to say is having a strong military is important. But at the same time, the big thing we're worried about is the $16 trillion debt mark we're going to hit next month or next week.
How does that affect anything?
Well, how does it affect anything? Look at the Budget Control Act and the Super Committee that
gave
us sequestration.
We're paying an incredibly low interest rate. People want to park their money in our debt. And by the way, that debt is far less as a percentage of our GDP than the debt that we had after World War II. And you know how Dwight Eisenhower, a brilliant military general, paid? We were at 127% of GDP of debt. After World War II. I know, we're approaching that. We're in the neighborhood of 100% right now, or a little over. So you know how Eisenhower paid that off?
I don't.
He grew the economy. He built highways from one end of this country to the other, the Eisenhower highway system. He built new schools. He built new hospitals. He created infrastructure. He gave money and credits to companies for innovation and R&D. And he pushed the GI Bill like crazy, you know, with a huge advertising campaign so that men all over the United States, mostly men, but women as well, but mostly men who'd come back from World War II, would actually sign up for college and get college degrees. So we had the government stimulating the economy by putting an entire generation of people through college, including the fathers of several of the people who are going to be speaking tonight at the Republican National Convention, and who were the very first in their families to have that. And that stimulation that Eisenhower did in the early 1950s not only got us out of the debt that we had and the recession that had been a piece of it, but built over the next 30 years the strongest industrial economy in the history of the United States and the strongest middle class.
So in light of the size of our federal government and the 4 years in a row of trillion-dollar deficits, your answer to the problem is spend more? With money don't have?
My money?
I don't know how that gets us out of the debt and deficit
problems. I would do two
things.
If we look at the debt, first of all, about a quarter of the debt is the Bush tax cuts. That's going to expire. About a quarter of the debt is the result of the Bush recession. There's not much we can do about that except stimulate the economy. And that's where I'm suggesting Eisenhower's solution. And I think Eisenhower's solution would take care of half of the debt. About a quarter of the debt is the result of the fact that the Medicare cannot negotiate drug prices for like the military can, like TRICARE can. TRICARE can buy penicillin. They buy 500,000 tablets. They can get them for a penny apiece. Medicare has to pay $5 a tablet. This is legislation that was pushed by the Republicans to hurt Medicare.
Well,
and
I believe
so,
there's a Medicare
you
reform.
You want to deal with the debt problem, I can just go right through the debt right now and tell you where it all came from and how we can get rid of all of it. No problem.
Hey, I like what you said about Medicare. I mean, hopefully you and I could agree that it needs to be reformed.
It would be a good idea if they could at least negotiate drug prices.
If they could at least negotiate, so the government sort of price controls is the answer with that.
I'm talking the free market. Right now, if the U.S. military wants to buy a million tablets of aspirin, they go to Bayer and they say, okay, we know that your price on one tablet, you know, you go in the hospital, what do they charge you for an aspirin? $5, right?
The problem is you don't know what they charge you at the hospital.
Well, yeah, but, you know, that's a whole other argument. But the point is they're going to charge you a retail price. So the military, the Department of Defense, goes to Bayer Company and says, we want to buy a million tablets of aspirin. How much is it going to be? And Bayer says, okay, it's a tenth of a penny apiece. If Medicare goes to Bayer, they are not allowed by law to say what is the wholesale price. They have to say, what would the retail price be if I walked into a pharmacy and I bought one tablet of aspirin? And that is what Medicare has to pay for that aspirin. That was put into place by Billy Towson, the Republican from Louisiana. It was voted into place by the Republicans during the Bush administration. Billy Towson got a special exemption to leave Congress 2 months early. He went to work for, as a $2 million a year head of the pharmaceutical lobbying association. And that is a good chunk of your deficit
it's not a huge chunk of the deficit. You're picking about 20% piece of that. That is 20% of our debt. Medicare.
Absolutely.
Until you deal with the structure of Medicare.
That's what I'm talking about.
No,
They turned it into a hustle for their pharmaceutical buddies.
Until you provide any sort of transparency in cost of what people are paying for, fee for service as it's currently structured, there's no incentives for costs to ever go down because the free market doesn't shine into the Medicare system as it currently exists. And so what I like a proposal like a premium support plan where you do provide money to individuals to choose Medicare as it exists.
So let's have health savings accounts.
Try other things. You have to give people choice, first of all, and you have to have transparency.
I'm sorry. If I'm having a heart attack, I don't want choice. I just want to dial 911 and get it taken care of. But I get your point, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, good talking with you. Pete Hegseth, President of Concerned Veterans for America.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Their website, by the way, concernedveteransforamerica.org. You can check it all out there. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And I am back and pleased to be here with you. Is Marita available? Is she ready to go? Somebody stick a pair of headphones on her? Okay. I don't know if anybody can hear me there. We have Talk Radio News Service is running a studio for us at the Republican National Convention. And maybe they're just not listening to us. I'm not sure. Because Marita Noon, the executive director of Energy Makes America Great, Inc., and author of her 20th book, Energy Freedom, should be our next guest. She's ready to go. Okay.
I'm here. I'm here for you,
great.
Baby.
Great. I've been talking about you for the last 2 minutes.
Sorry about that. I did hear you talking about me, and I appreciate it. I like it when a man talks about me.
Well, I've been explaining. You're the executive director at Energy Makes America Great, Inc., the advocacy arm of Citizens United for Responsible Energy. You're an author. Your 20th book, most recent book, Energy Freedom. The website is energymakesamericagreat.org. Your name, again, Marita Noon. Marita, what about the Republican policy of giving more tax breaks and subsidies to fossil fuels and cutting back on renewable energies is going to make America energy great?
Well, actually, I think we should eliminate all subsidies for energy, not just for wind and solar.
Why?
But I think we should eliminate all subsidies so that they can play on a level playing field.
Why? Isn't one of the purposes of government to do what is best for the nation? And if what's best for our nation is to say, you know, we really should stop importing oil from Saudi Arabia, we really should stop, you know, being in the middle of these wars, you know, that have to do with oil, then the best thing for our nation would be to actually subsidize the way that Dwight Eisenhower subsidized the national highway system, you know, to the way that we subsidized NASA, the way that we subsidized the development of the internet, the way that we subsidized, you know, good, you know, our food and drug programs so that we have safe food and drugs. Wouldn't it be wise for us to subsidize an energy program that allows us to tell Saudi Arabia that they can take a leap the next time they want to hold a Friday execution?
Okay, Tom, tell me, what energy do you think we should subsidize?
I think we should be subsidizing anything that does not produce carbon and is not a fossil fuel. I think we should be subsidizing.
Okay, so that would include wind and solar, is that
wind,
correct?
Wind, solar, geothermal, okay, wave energy, biomass, bunch of them.
How do the, if we subsidize those, let's just say I agree with you, and we subsidize those, right, how does that help us to tell Saudi Arabia to take a leap?
Well, for example, about a month and a half ago, I did this show from Iceland. And in Iceland, the government paid for the cost of drilling down into the volcano there, and they brought this energy out, and 100% of all the hot water in the city and 99% of all the electricity in the city is now produced by volcanic activity, by geothermal.
Okay.
This was a government-sponsored, government-funded program. It's now being run by private corporations,
Let me get back to how does that help us tell Saudi Arabia to take a leap?
And that allowed Iceland to tell Saudi Arabia, sorry, you know, we're not going to be fighting your wars anymore or whatever, you know. Saudi Arabia doesn't even allow women to drive. We're criticizing countries' human rights records, and yet we're subsidizing Saudi Arabia.
But again, tell me how that does not, having electricity come from wind, solar, or geothermal, and I love geothermal, but having electricity come from those alternative sources does absolutely zero for our energy independence. It does not allow us to tell Saudi Arabia to take a leap. I'm with you. I would love to tell Saudi Arabia to take a leap, but you know what? Those resources that you're suggesting that we subsidize, they produce electricity. And in this country, we already are electricity independent. We have enough coal, we have enough natural gas, we have enough uranium to provide for this country's electricity needs for the next several hundred years. We are electricity independent already. So that has not producing, subsidizing electricity.
No, if we are looking at transportation, you're absolutely right. 95% of our transportation costs.
You started with you want to tell Saudi Arabia to take a leap, which I agree with you. I would love to tell Saudi Arabia.
There's missing in your logic here, Marita, and that is that you're assuming that we can't use electricity to move vehicles.
No, I'm not. I just want to make it clear that we are electricity independent already.
Well, you know, if you want to use our fossil fuels, I'm saying we shouldn't even be using our fossil fuels.
Nuclear is not a fossil fuel. Uranium requires
massive amounts of fossil fuels to mine uranium, to transport uranium, to refine uranium, and we still haven't figured out a way to store uranium. And it requires massive amounts of coal water to keep those power plants going. We got power plants being shut down because the water's too hot and because they're running out of water. That's no solution. But that, you know, setting that argument aside, I'm with you that we are oil dependent on our transportation. Denmark, we did our show for a week from Denmark a couple of years ago. Denmark put together a program where I believe it was $5 billion, where, you know, they're producing 18% of their electricity through these windmills, but they're running all night. Nobody's using the electricity. So they're building this fleet of electric cars. And during the daytime, if you plug your car in, you drive to work and plug your car in, you can sell the charge in your car back into the grid. And then at home, when you drive home, you can buy electricity back at home. You buy it for less than you sell it. You actually make a profit on it. Denmark has already seen there, and I'm sure you're familiar with these statistics. I mean, this is your field. Denmark is up to 30-35% of their energy being used by electricity, and this is the transportation sector that they're using. Why don't we do smart things like that?
Well, I think we should if that is what the free market demands. I mean, you and I are going
to
be philosophically
opposed. To hell with the free market. Let's do what's best for our country.
Well, how is it best for our country to raise the cost of energy?
I'm not sure where that came from.
Denmark
has got cheaper electricity. Iceland has free electricity. I'm suggesting.
But you know what? They don't have the natural resources that we have in America.
Yeah, well, we've got enormous amounts of wind. I mean, 20% of electricity in Iowa and Texas is coming from wind. But hang on just a second, Marita.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I should let you have the last word. I'm sorry. Marita Noon, the Executive Director of Energy Makes America Great, of energymakesamericagreat.org. Thank you, Marita.
No problem.
And on the line with us, live from the Republican National Convention in Tampa, is the National Press Secretary for Obama 2012, Ben LaBolt. Of course, the website, barackobama.com, Twitter, @BenLaBolt, L-A-B-O-L-T. Ben, what are you doing there behind enemy lines?
Well, that's what America's all about, isn't it? We just want to make sure that, you know, the Republicans have brought in Hollywood producers and Madison Avenue advertising executives to try to reinvent Mitt Romney this week, and we're going to remind Americans of his actual record. So he'll tell you that in the private sector, he created jobs, but actually he profited off of bankrupting companies and outsourcing jobs. He made all the same promises in Massachusetts when he was running for office that he's making today. He said he'd pick up the pace of job creation, that he'd get the deficit under control, and none of those things happened in Massachusetts. Instead, he just promoted tax cuts for the wealthiest in Massachusetts while he raised taxes on the middle class. Those policies didn't work then, and they certainly won't work now.
Yeah, I've had Republican after Republican after Republican on the show, and I keep asking them, you know, really simple questions like, you know, do you really think that George Bush's policies, you know, revisiting them is going to bring us? I'm getting no answers from any of these people. I mean, they want to start talking about Ronald Reagan and stuff. It's
well, that's right,
bizarre.
And those are the facts. It led to the slowest pace of job creation since World War II. And, you know, instead of investing in areas like education, research and development, and infrastructure, we see countries around the world racing to invest in those. These are areas where Romney and Ryan would trim us back.
Right, right. It seems like the Jude Winiski's two Santa Claus theory is also going to be front and center at the Republican National Convention. This was back in 1976. He published this thing in the Wall Street Journal, which became the holy grail for the Reagan administration, which was when a Republican is in office, spend like a drunken sailor, run up the debt as much as possible, because the Democrats had always been seen as Santa Clauses. You know, they gave us 40-hour work weeks, and they gave us Medicare, and they gave us Social Security. And then when a Democrat comes into office, starts screaming about the debt that was created by the Republicans, starts screaming about the debt, and force the Democrats to shoot Santa Claus. In other words, to shoot their own, you know, their own programs. And I am hearing this over, and I had a guy on about the military, and I'm saying, so what are you concerned about the military? And he says, we're concerned about the debt. And I said, how does that affect anything? You know, it's,
Well, we know that they're bluffing, because the president put a $4 trillion deficit reduction plan on the table. But they refuse to do what every bipartisan debt commission has said you need to do, which is you need a mix of tough spending cuts and revenue. He signed $2 trillion worth of spending cuts into law, but we've got to ask the wealthiest Americans to do their fair share. In fact, the New York Times reported that Paul Ryan discouraged the Republican leaders from negotiating with the president over the deficit reduction package because he thought it'd help the president's reelection. I mean, he put politics before country on the issue of deficit reduction, which was supposed to be his top issue.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't just discourage them. I'm sure you're familiar with Robert Draper's book, where he points out that on the night of the inauguration of Barack Obama, January 20th, 2009, Frank Luntz, Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Henseling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, John Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker got together at the caucus room, the restaurant over at 9th and D, here in D.C., and basically swore that for the next 3 years they would do everything they could to economically obstruct this president so that they could run against him and turn him into a four-year president, one-term president.
That obstruction is one of the things that's going to be on the ballot this November. We know it's a bad governing strategy. The president's had a jobs plan on the table for the past year that would create a million jobs now, filled with ideas that Republicans have supported in the past. But their top priority, as Mitch McConnell said publicly, was defeating the president. It wasn't to fix the economy.
Right.
We know that's a bad governing strategy, but I think the American people are going to prove in November that that's a failed political strategy as well.
Do you see, I mean, this, what I just shared with you is not a secret. It's the topic of Robert Draper's book and numerous articles and things like this. I mean, there's lots of this stuff scattered around, evidence of Republicans doing what is actually harmful to the United States of America in order to hurt the president so that they can, you know, beat him in this presidential election. Is that the kind of thing that, I mean, how do we get that message out without sounding too negative? It's almost like it's a historian should be out there telling these stories.
Well, Mitt Romney himself has opposed this jobs plan that's been on the table for the past year, and he's proposed no alternative. I mean, this is Mitt Romney's M.O. He opposes things and then doesn't propose an alternative. He says that he'd repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, but he hasn't said what he'd replace it with.
Right.
He says that he'll grant $5 trillion tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires, and then he won't say how he's going to pay for it. I mean, in many ways, he's been running a substanceless campaign that's been driven by attacks on the president, his policies, without proposing an alternative. He's outsourced those policies to Paul Ryan, embraced his budget plan, and we know what the implications of that are for middle-class families.
How is it that Paul Ryan's budget plan, which would take Mitt Romney's tax rate from 14%, 13.9% down to 1%, how is it that that just doesn't have Americans all over America going, are you kidding?
Well, and I think the key point here is that taxes get cut on the top 5% of the population, but they go up on 95% of the population. If you're the average middle-class family with kids, they go up by $2,000. But this shouldn't come as a surprise. That's the same thing that Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts.
Right.
He cut taxes on the wealthiest Massachusetts residents and then raised taxes on the middle class to the tune of $750 million a year.
Wow. Ben Lebolt, we're talking with Ben Lebolt, the National Press Secretary for Obama 2012, BarackObama.com is the website, Twitter, at Ben Lebolt. Ben, how do you respond to the Republicans who say, and they are saying it, they've said it on this show, they will certainly be saying it tonight, that Barack Obama is running the largest deficits in history, that he's borrowing more money than 44 presidents before him, you know, quack, quack, quack.
Well, let's look at the drivers of the deficit. You had two unfunded wars and tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans that were passed in 2001 and 2003 that led the deficit to explode. The president inherited a $1 trillion deficit. He signed $2 trillion worth of deficit reduction into law, and he's got a balanced $4 trillion deficit reduction package on the table. He bucked Democratic orthodoxy, put tough spending cuts in there that other Democrats wouldn't have signed into law, and said, I want to work with you on this because it's a national priority.
But the Republicans
couldn't deliver their caucus because they refused to ask the wealthiest Americans for a dime, and we know that all Americans have to do their fair share to reduce the deficit.
So at what point do you stop trying to negotiate with people who are trying to destroy you and are unwilling to negotiate?
Well, I think many of these questions will be settled at the polls in November. The president talked about the opportunity that Americans have to break the stalemate between two divisions.
Yeah.
Do you agree with the president that we should build the economy from the middle class out, or do you agree with Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan that tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans will magically create jobs when we've tried them before and they didn't in the past? They led to the slowest pace of job creation since World War II.
Right, right. And I beg your pardon? Oh, okay. Ben, I just heard that you've got to get going. So Ben Lebolt, National Press Secretary for Obama 2012, BarackObama.com, the website. Ben, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
And good luck behind enemy lines there.
I'm surviving just fine. Thank you.
I'm sure you are. I've been to the RNC myself the last two ones. I was hoping to be at this one. A lot going on today. It's pretty amazing. Kevin in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. It's nice to see you back again.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Excuse me. I'm kind of out of the loop. Could you, like, briefly clue me in on what exactly happened to you?
What happened to me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was supposed to have what was a minor prostate surgery, and some stitch inside there busted, and my abdomen filled up with urine, and I ended up in the ER, and my blood pressure crashing and dying and or whatever, and it just became a horrible mess, and I ended up having holes drilled in me and walking around with tubes and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And
yeah.
So now I'm recovering from that.
Experience.
You know, what was supposed to be a 4-day thing, 5-day thing that people wouldn't even know about because I'd call it a vacation turned into a 4-week disaster.
Wow.
So, and I still hurt a lot, but but I'm better.
Yeah, not a great hospital experience to.
It was my first hospital experience in my life, and I got to tell you, what I learned out of that is that the people in a hospital who know what they're doing, who know everything that's going on, and who you want to rely on if you possibly can, and who you need to make friends with first and foremost are the nurses.
Yeah, absolutely. I was in the hospital for 5 days myself, and had a great crew of nurses and nurses' aides helping me out, and they were good people. But yeah. I'll tell you what, it was harder than hell to sleep in there, too.
Yeah, yeah. Every 3 hours they want to come in and take your blood pressure and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. What I'd like to say is, you mentioned when Donatelli was on, was it from GOPAC? You know, are these people suddenly changing their minds about the middle class and suddenly, you know, trying to, you know, save and help the middle class? That's what they're putting forward. I watched a little bit of Reince Priebus giving his speech earlier this afternoon, and right after him, I think it was like the co-chair or deputy chair of the RNC,
right.
The committee, woman, Kim somebody from Florida. You know, they're talking about saving the middle class and how they're going to help the middle class, but everything they do seems to
destroys the middle class. No, the only way these guys can win is by lying, and that's what they're doing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
46 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back with more here on the Tom Hartman Program. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Rich in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Rich, what's on your mind today?
Hey, welcome back, Tom. It's really great to hear you back.
Thank you.
Your show. I love your tagline when you sign off with the Walter Cronkite on the News Bites, and that's the way it is.
Yeah, thank you.
It's awesome. You know, he's got to be rolling his grave along with Edward R. Murrow, David Brinkley, and but anyway, I wanted to you know, that Frank Donatelli. You know, I love how all these guys always say, and Reagan said too. You know, the problem with government is it's too going to run for president. You know, and he said I put him up against Obama any day. You know, I love that they forgot the fact that Reagan bailed out the car companies. He gave Lee Iacocca a big fat bailout. His buddy.
You're
Lee
right,
Iacocca.
Chrysler. Iacocca took $1 salary for a year in exchange for the bailout from Reagan.
Yeah, and then he also did the same thing with the SNLs. He bailed out the banks.
Well, he didn't just bail them out. Know. He took them over. He socialized them.
I don't know how you can put up with these guys. You know, these they're a bunch of. You know, schmuck hacks, you know. And
well,
how you
I appreciate, you know, brilliant viewers and listeners like you who keep reminding me of some of the details that I might have forgotten that I will use in my next argument. Thank you for
you
that.
Know, and all those guys, Tom, all those guys, one more thing, all those guys, including that lady, you know, she agreed with you. But you know what? They're all down there, including that libertarian guy. They're all, you know, they're at the Republican thing, you know, taking money, you know, it trickles all the way down.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it, like that last guy, Ahmed, said, you know, no wonder we can't get off the Saudi nipple, like you said, because of these multi-million dollar subsidies, you know?
Sure.
I mean, there's, you know, who killed the electric car back in 92? I remember, you
yep.
know, Tom Hanks had one, you know?
Yep.
Anyway, I'm glad you're back, Tom. I know you got a lot of other callers. It's a busy show. I love your show. You take care, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much. Great to hear from you, Rich.
I'm volunteering for President Obama, by the way.
Oh, so, good on you, and good luck with that.
I know how you say, yeah, democracy is not a spectator sport. Take care, Tom.
There you go. It is not. And thanks for listening to AM 760, Rich. Great to hear from you. Ralph, listening on WCPT in Dallas, Texas, actually. You're listening to the you must be listening to the web stream. What's up, Ralph?
Yes, I am. Tom, I wanted to talk about the John Birch Society and how they've infiltrated the Republican Party and how they're kind of really under the guise of the Tea Party.
Yeah.
All this is founded, or one of the co-founders is Ed Koch, the
Fred Koch's
father.
Fred Koch, yeah.
Fred Koch, what did I say, Ed? I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's okay.
A lot of people don't understand where the Republican Party are coming from, where they're getting these ideas, but they're using all the John Birch Society principles.
Yep.
I mean, they believe that liberals are really secret communist traitors.
Yep.
And that they use the fundamental Christian principles, you know, as far as the U.S. Constitution goes. They're against wealth
The fundamentally, here's the fundamental essence of it. They believe that anything that works to the public good or anything that is used by the public, by the people en masse, whether it's mass transportation or whether it's, you know, healthcare or whatever it is, if it is provided by government, it is evil.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the essential summary of it. And it's not just that it's evil, it's communist. Nowadays they would call it socialist probably because communist just doesn't have the sting anymore. And besides that, the only communist country out there these days that I know of that openly calls itself that is China. And, you know, look around your house. Do you see anything that's not made in China? So, we don't pick on them all that much. So.
No, we don't. But I think, you know, growing up in the 50s and 60s, they were scary. And they still are today, but they... But William Buckley, he marginalized him, you know, for going after Eisenhower.
Yeah.
And,
well, they went after Buckley too, you know, the John Birch Society.
They definitely did. And, so they kind of took a low profile for a while, but in 2010, they co-sponsored the, CPAC.
I remember.
Then that's when they, you know, really started getting into the, Tea Party.
Yeah. I would submit to you that while the John Birch Society continues to live on as its own entity and it's been through a lot of changes over the years, that really, you know, Fred Koch is dead, Daddy Koch is dead, but his sons, David and Charles, have taken the principles of the John Birch Society, or many of them, added a few of their own, a few new ones, and reinvented this as the Tea Party. And as all of these, you know, Freedom Works and all these other AstroTurf groups that they've got. And, the John Birch Society lives and it has taken over the Republican Party and it is trying to take over the United States. And if it does, I fear for the future of this country. Ralph, thank you very much for the call. David in Pacific Washington. Hey, David, we got a minute to the break. What's up?
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to speak to you after what you went through.
Thank you.
I was just listening in the last hour when you were talking with Chuck Woolery, and he mentions a challenge of what government entity might be successful, and I would nominate the post office for that because they have run the post office my entire life and always brought mail from overseas to my home.
Yep, it was the post office was always successful and always paid for itself until 2005 when the Republicans passed poison pill legislation to force the post office to set aside money to pay for the retirement medical costs of their retirees 75 years in the future, which is $5 billion a year.
The austerity measures you speak of.
Yeah, and this is insane. I mean, the post office was making such a profit in 2004, they were doing so well, that they were literally talking about converting a third of their entire fleet into solar-powered cars as a way of jumping America into the solar business and building solar batteries and all this cool stuff. And the conservatives were like, we can't have that. We can't have a successful government program. We can't have that at all. And so they put this poison pill in that is killing the post office. And Bernie Sanders and a few other good people out there are trying to fix it. Excellent point, David. Thanks a lot for calling, and thanks a lot for listening to AM 1090. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Glenn Hubbard is on the line with us. He's the senior economics advisor to Mitt Romney. He's an economist and dean at the Columbia University Graduate School of Business. Previously served as the deputy assistant secretary at the U.S. Department of the Treasury from 91 to 93 and chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors during the Bush administration from 2001 to 2003. His website, glennhubbard.net, and many are speculating that if Mitt Romney is elected president, he could even be the next Fed chairman. Glenn Hubbard, welcome. It's a pleasure and an honor to have you with us, sir.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
How is it that after, you know, if you look at the last 60 or 70 years of history, we see that average wages tracked productivity almost perfectly continuously until the Reagan administration. Then wages flattened out and productivity continued to increase and all that money seemed to go to CEO pay instead of wages. We've seen now the result of Reaganomics, trickle-down economics, whatever you want to call it, supply-side economics, for 30 years. It's been a disaster for the middle class. How do you think you can continue to sell this to the American people?
You know, we have long-term structural problems in America that aren't Democrat problems or Republican problems. They're problems we have to deal with. And we have seen wages for many people fail to keep pace with productivity. Compensation has kept pace with productivity, so how could both of those things be true? We've seen very sharply rising health care costs, and we've seen problems and opportunity for many lower and middle income Americans. We really need to rethink our employment policy in the United States. We want to increase growth, but it's got to be broadly shared.
So how would you do that?
Well, first, getting growth is about changing our tax code, getting the size of government right, getting regulation that supports growth.
Isn't it about creating demand?
Well, you know, you can't create demand in an environment that has this much policy uncertainty. Business executives I speak to are very concerned about hiring people or making investments with this level of policy uncertainty.
But no,
we can fix that.
Respectfully, no business executive, I'm one of them, no business executive in his right mind would refuse to hire somebody if there was demand for his products, if he could make more money hiring more employees.
Well, that's true, but let's unpack what you're saying. In an environment of policy uncertainty where you don't know what future taxes are, the future size of government, the future of regulation.
But nobody's ever known those things.
Well, you know, with respect, this is the greatest level of uncertainty. For economists who measure this, we've probably cost our economy since 2007 more than 2 million jobs just from policy uncertainty. And that's something we can fix. But you started to ask me a really important question about what we can do for lower and middle-income Americans. And it really is about changing our employment policy to have much better training programs, much more focus on education and skill development. This country can do better, both Democrats and Republicans.
So by policy uncertainty, are you talking about the effort over the last 3.5 years by the Republican Party to obstruct all of the or most of the Obama administration programs that might move the economy forward, that would bring jobs home from overseas, things like that?
Well, we may want to have a little history lesson, you and I, because the first 2 years of President Obama's presidency, he had a Democratic Congress. Anything he wanted to do for the economy, he could have done then.
He could not.
He didn't.
The rules of the Senate allowed Tom Coburn to stop legislation after legislation after legislation, and you know it, sir.
Well, that's not really true on tax and budget, but that's arcana. We can certainly disagree on policy.
You know, Nancy Pelosi, for example, got a piece of legislation out of the House of Representatives when they were, you know, both were controlled by the Democrats, that said no more tax breaks for companies that send jobs overseas like Bain used to do. And by the way, we will give you a tax break if you bring your jobs back home. It got a majority. It got more than 50 votes in the Senate, but the Republicans filibustered it. That's just one of many examples. There were I can give you over 200 examples if you want the long list, but of programs and policies that would have directly helped the average American worker that Republicans blocked, in my opinion, because they were trying to harm the economy to advance the interests of the Republican presidential nominee, in this case, Mitt Romney.
I don't think that President Obama wants to harm the economy. I don't think Mitt Romney wants to harm the economy. I think there's serious differences in policy. And we need to make America a safe place to invest in again, and we can. And it requires both sides compromising on sensible policies that not only enhance growth, but really, as you said quite correctly, share the benefits of that growth.
So first of all, I'm curious about you, if you don't mind. How would you describe yourself in terms of economic theory? I mean, we've had Alan Greenspan, who was sort of an Ayn Randian. Following von Hayek. We've got the Milton's Friedman School of Economics. We've got, obviously, you know, there has been, you know, people following, what's his name, John Kenneth Galbraith and others. What is your economic philosophy, in a nutshell, if you don't mind?
No, it's a great question. I think that economics is a powerful discipline to help us understand the power that markets can bring to bear to make people's lives better and to help us solve social programs and problems around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I call myself more of a practical problem solver.
So you're more of a pragmatist?
I would consider that, yes.
Yeah. Are there any countries that you can identify in the world that have successful economies and success, and more importantly, successful middle classes that have not done so by significant government involvement, but rather have done so by the free market?
Well, the United States, historically, I think, meets that example of definitely rising economic growth being broadly shared. There are a number of trends around the world that have made that tough the world over, as you know. But we can change policy in this country to help make that happen. Unfortunately, on both sides of the aisle, there's not always support for that.
Wasn't the United States building of the great middle class in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s, wasn't that the consequence of government policies, though? The GI Bill, GI, you know, support for home loans, the Eisenhower transportation bills, Eisenhower building schools and hospitals. I mean, he basically, we were at 127% of GDP in debt after World War II. He basically stimulated us out of it and paid off that debt. Isn't that an example of government policy creating a middle class?
It's certainly the case that government has a strong role to play in creating an educated society and created infrastructure. But America's growth, any successful nation's growth, is about innovation and the private sector, not about government.
Okay. And where do you see, if Mitt Romney is elected president, what would be your first policy recommendations?
Well, what Governor Romney has said is that day one he would introduce energy regulation that would create jobs in the energy sector, to move from Obamacare to much more market-oriented healthcare system, tax reform and spending restraint, all together, which could create another 12 million jobs in this country in his first term.
Aren't those just variations on what George Bush did?
Not at all. George Bush actually, sadly, in my view, let spending get out of control under his watch. Governor Romney is proposing to restore the size of government to its pre-financial crisis level, about 20% of GDP.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's fairly small right now, is it not?
What's that?
I thought that we were taking in about 18% of GDP right now.
No, government spending is about 24% of GDP.
Right.
And Governor Romney would put that back to its historical average of 20% of GDP. If we keep government at 24% of GDP, we'll have to have massive tax increases on everyone to pay for that, or cut back strongly on education.
And yet Canada is at 53% of GDP. Most of your Scandinavian countries are over 60% of GDP. As you know, most Northern European countries are between 45 and 55% of GDP. They all seem to be working just fine. Why should we be fixated on 20%?
Well, let's keep in mind some of the Nordic countries you mentioned actually have had major tax and spending reforms and actually have more favorable regulation than the United States. The model that's closer to your worldview is continental Europe, and I don't think we want to go there.
Okay. All right. Glenn Hubbard, the senior economic advisor to Mitt Romney, economist and dean at the Columbia University Graduate School, glennhubbard.net, his website. Sir, thank you so much for being
with
us. My
pleasure.
Great talking.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more from the RNC and your calls and my thoughts right after this.
I'll tell you what, $10,000, $10,000 bet. No one has ever asked to see my birth certificate.
Yeah.
I like being able to fire people who provide services to me.
This is mid-song?
I'm running for office, for Pete's sake. I can't have illegal
votes. A parody by Roy Zimmerman. Okay, good on him. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our guest is not with us. He's not yet available. Congressman Tim Griffin may or may not be with us. It is a zoo in Tampa there at the Republican National Convention. Kyle in Schenectady, New York. Hey, Kyle, what's on your mind?
Hello there, Tom. Well, I want to tell you that you had that your guest earlier. What was his name? The recent one that talked about uncertainty and government regulation?
Glenn Hubbard.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. It's funny. I was just thinking, actually, 5 minutes before that call, that the phrase from last summer was business uncertainty. I'm a business owner, and I'm going to be uncertain about everything because of the quote-unquote regulations on business. Well, my point is, isn't that just talking points? Because why are they just talking about regulations for business? No, why are they against regulations for business, but they want to enforce regulations on women's bodies? I mean, if no regulation and low taxes creates jobs, where are the jobs in the past 30 years?
Right. Well, that was my first question to him is, you know, we've tried Reaganomics. We've tried your way for 32 years here now, and doesn't seem to have worked all that well. Why should we keep on doing it? And I'm not sure I got a clear and succinct answer, at least one that I could understand. But this whole uncertainty thing is it's a canard. It's a straw man. It is a way of saying that basically, you know, we don't like the guy who's in there and we want our guy, and our guy will be consistent. And somehow would they think that Mitt Romney, Mr. Flip-Flop, is going to be consistent. And if you look over the last 100 years at the top marginal tax rate, at the corporate tax rate, at, you know, regulations, at the number of bills passed through Congress, at any of these things, they're all over the map. You know, they're just every single Congress has its own idea. Every president has his own way of doing things. And there has never been a time in the United States other than arguably during the 15 years of the FDR presidency. But even then, you had World War II in the middle of it. There has been no time in the history of America when there was business certainty, when a businessman could say, you know, if I invest $10,000 in this, I know that a year from now I will have $12,000. And you shouldn't have that kind of certainty, because the whole point of investing is taking risks.
Absolutely. I mean, didn't you find it interesting that you asked him a question about pointing out a country that actually used private interests and free market principles, and he pointed to the United States historically, which basically there is no free market economy here. It's all about their regulations and their corporate subsidies.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, they don't even know what they're talking about, frankly.
Absolutely. Yeah, and there is. Say that again. Oh, the congressman is not here. Okay. All right.
Okay.
No, you're absolutely right. Kyle, I'm going to move along to the next caller. Thanks a lot for the call. You said it very, 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 very well. Vicki in Gilmanton, Wisconsin. Hey, Vicki, what's up?
Hi. I was attracted by a title of an article called The Conservative Psyche, How Do Ordinary People Come to Embrace Paul Ryan's Cruelty?
Yeah.
In which they...
I read it. It was on Alternet a couple days ago.
Pardon me?
I read it on Alternet a couple days ago. It was brilliant.
Oh, yeah. And they talked about motivated reasoning.
Yeah.
And very interesting that this was first put forth by a sociologist named Oscar Lewis in 1961.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
In his book called The Children of Sanchez.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought it was interesting that people who have already formulated an opinion will not respond to facts, only that go against their beliefs,
yeah,
but will pick through, take the facts that they want, and if they get a fact in front of their face that proves them wrong, they will actually double down.
Sure. Especially
believe.
Conservatives. Liberals tend to be more brain. Yeah, more able to be persuaded of things, even to become a conservative, arguably. But conservatives, because their primary reaction is fear. You know, when, for example, they did a study where they measured how long people looked at a car accident, you know, or at a gruesome sight, you know, somebody being, you know, beat up on the ground bleeding. And conservatives look longer than liberals look at them. And the reason why is because their reticular activating system, their lower brain, their limbic brain, is wired to respond to fear, to fight and flight,
right.
And rather than to thinking and reasoning and emotion. It's not to say they're not capable of those things. That's their default mode.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so yeah, when they're presented with these, and that's one of the reasons that Mitt Romney is changing his campaign to one of be afraid of Obama, be afraid of all those black people out there on welfare. You know, he's saying Obama's trying to do away with work to welfare? Well, no, he's not actually. But, and 60% of people on welfare are white people. But, you know, no, don't tell the Republicans that because they don't want to know.
Well,
you know,
you can tell them that, but it doesn't matter. They'll just double down on what they think.
Yeah. You know, John Kenneth Galbraith, the esteemed economist advisor to FDR, said the modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy. That is the search for the superior moral justification for selfishness. And with a tip of the hat to Tom from Minneapolis, and who keeps passing this along to me. And it is so right. It is so right. And
another quick question,
yeah,
please. May I ask where you check your facts? Do you have a couple sites?
It depends on the fact.
Okay.
I don't have any one go-to place for anything, frankly. I read probably 15 websites a day and 3 or 4 newspapers. So, you know, it would depend on what it is. And when I'm writing a book, I read a lot more than that. So I can't recommend anything in particular. I'm sorry. Thanks a lot for the call, Vicki, and keep up the great work. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So what little entertaining tidbits are coming out of the RNC next? I'll tell you all about that right after this opportunity for you to support your local station. That's the good, the bad, and the very, very castigenously ugly. The good. New York State Senator Daniel Squadron. Despite losing many of its members over the past several months, ALEC is still alive and well and still influencing corporate-friendly legislation across America. And since somehow ALEC is still registered as a nonprofit group and not as a lobbying group, it can influence as much legislation as it wants without anyone knowing. However, New York State Senator Daniel Squadron, a Democrat, is trying to change that. He has created a web page on his official site asking state legislators or candidates for state legislatures to sign a pledge disclosing whether or not ALEC has influenced any legislation that they may have sponsored or introduced. While the pledge is completely voluntary, it's clear Squadron is trying to put some transparency and accountability back in government, and that's exactly what America needs. The bad Donald Trump. Trump, the darling of the Republican Party and the Fox so-called news network, really doesn't like it when journalists call him out. In fact, he hates it so much that he calls them names on Twitter. Recently, Trump called Salon's Alex Perini a total joke in political circles. In Vanity Fair's Julie Wiener, a third-rate stalker. Well, this morning, a man with the world's worst hair plugs decided to lash out at Arianna Huffington. In a tweet, Trump said, "Arianna Huffington is unattractive both inside and out. I fully understand why her former husband left her for a man. He made a good decision." End of quote. I don't know what's worse, the fact that Donald Trump thinks people care about what he has to say, or the fact that Republicans actually listen to him. And the very, very ugly Tom Smith. A week after Congressman Todd Akin made his mind-blowing legitimate rape comment, Smith, a Republican Senate candidate from Pennsylvania, said something almost as ignorant, if such a thing is possible. In an interview with AP yesterday, Smith compared getting pregnant from rape to having a baby out of wedlock. Smith thinks that getting pregnant as a result of a brutal sexual assault with major psychological effects throughout your lifetime is the same as having a baby through consensual sex. You would think every Republican and their brother would be watching their words after Akin's gaffe, but I guess not. So again, we have another Republican who is just completely out of touch with women and sexual assault. And that is very, very ugly. Boy, that's mind-bogglingly ugly. How do you get uglier than that? I don't know. Howard in Miami, Florida, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Howard, what's on your mind today?
I don't even know anymore, you know. It's what's on my mind is I despair for this election because it seems the Democrats have not learned from John Kerry, because John Kerry's primary error, in my
you'll forgive me, presumptuous estimation, was that when the Swift Boat Veterans for Gag Truth came out with everything that they came out with, he didn't respond for 2 weeks and 3 weeks, however long it was.
Right.
And then when he did, he responded very lukewarmly, as I remember.
Yes.
And he proved two things. One, he proved the truth of what they said, and he proved that he was a wuss by not coming out. What he should have told them right away is, go to hell, I earn those medals, and you know, you can stuff it.
Yeah.
And the Democrats, I don't know, maybe it's genetic. All they do is be on the defensive. They just seem to wait for the next Republican attack. And the conversation you had before with the press secretary for the DNC or whoever it was.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I missed your last sentence. Go ahead.
No, I said that the person that you had on earlier, the press secretary.
Are you talking about the press secretary for the Obama campaign?
Right.
Yes.
Right. It's. They need to go on the attack. Why don't they understand that? It's like I listen to the news media and people.
They
that
do.
Are, you know,
they do. They are going on the attack. The problem is that the news media is not picking it up.
I know, but they should go after the news media too.
Well, I don't disagree. I mean, here's the situation. When Franklin Roosevelt was president, this was in 1945. He's 44. He's running for re-election. And thank you for the call, Howard. Your point is very well made. Let me just illustrate this. He's running for re-election in 44, and the president of the United States. Now he can go on, and all the networks carried him. Everybody was listening to radio. TV wasn't pretty much around then, and you know, he had the nation's voice or ear rather, and so he called out the big lie strategy that was being used by the Democrats. Here's the first clip.
The opposition in this year has already imported into this campaign a very interesting thing because it's foreign. They have imported the propaganda technique invented by the dictators abroad. Remember, a number of years ago, there was a book, Mein Kampf, written by Hitler himself.
Now, so here, you know, everybody says, don't mention Hitler. You're not supposed to talk about Hitler in politics. Oh, no, don't do that. This is the president of the United States. This is Franklin Roosevelt. We are at war with Germany. It's 1944. He's running for re-election, and he's referring to Mein Kampf, Hitler's book, but he's not referring to it like, hey, Hitler's bad. This is why we're fighting Hitler. He's referring to it by saying the Democrats are using it as their playbook. Next clip.
Remember, a number of years ago, there was a book, Mein Kampf, written by Hitler himself. The technique was all set out in Hitler's book, and it was copied by the aggressors of Italy and Japan. According to that technique, you should never use a small falsehood, always a big one. For its very fantastic nature would make it more credible. If only you keep repeating it over and over and over again.
And there, I mean, literally the president of the United States talking about how the Republican Party was using the big lie strategy to try to defeat the Democrats, and that they had learned it from Mein Kampf, from Adolf Hitler's book, that used the big lie. And they used the big lie against John Kerry. I mean, here's a guy who was a war hero. He was decorated four times. He'd been, you know, shot a couple of times. I mean, boy, did he pay his dues. So what did they do? What's the biggest lie we can tell? Well, let's tell the lie that John Kerry was actually a coward. And now, you know, they're looking at Barack Obama, and here's Obama. He's you know, trying to bring the economy back, and several Republican governors had asked him for waivers so that they could experiment with the welfare to work program, because the whole TAN thing is timed out at 5 years and it's not working, and you know, it's so, you know, hey, can we fix this a little bit? And he says, yeah, sure, you can do that. And now they're accusing him of helping welfare people, because that's his base, don't you know? And of course, this is code for black people. These are just lies. plain old flat out lies that he's giving money from the stimulus fund to his buddies and his friends. Come on, he's never even worked in the business world. I mean, Mitt Romney, you know, went to school with millionaires and billionaires and knows these guys and is members of secret societies and all his other, but Barack Obama? Tell the biggest lie you can, repeat it over and over again, and people will believe it. Adolf Hitler was right. Franklin Roosevelt was right when he quoted Adolf Hitler. He was right when he called out the Democrats on it. This is why he said they hate me and I welcome their hatred. This is why he said these economic royalists say that we seek to destroy the institutions of America. What they really complain about is that we seek to take away their power and our commitment to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power. That is my favorite FDR quote of all time. And he just came out and said it. He called these guys out. And of course, I'm doing it here on the radio and on the TV, and we all need to be doing it. We all need to be doing it. Cora in Taos, New Mexico, listening on KVOT. Hey, Cora, what's up?
Well, first I want to say business uncertainty. The CEOs need to start hiring good astrologists and tarot readers, and that way they're not so weak-kneed about the future.
Great.
There's several good ones here in Taos.
Okay, I'm sure there are.
But anyway, I called about, you know, the president today said he wanted to raise the standard for new automobiles to 55 miles per gallon, and Romney has already slapped that down. And I would think even the most anti-science conservative would realize that the more miles per gallon you get, the less money you have to spend on oil.
Yeah, and gasoline. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And also there was that rumor that Mike Papantonio stated that it is rumored that Romney wants as chief of staff Jack Girard, who is the head of the American Petroleum Institute.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
He said it was a rumor, but you know, I guess they are good friends, and Girard is also a Mormon. I mean, they're good friends otherwise.
Oh, that's very interesting.
So, yeah, I found it interesting, too.
I should have, you know, I didn't listen to every day of my own show. That was one of the days when I was in a dilaudid haze trying to recover.
I'm so glad you're so much better now.
Me too. Thank you, Cora. And, yeah, I've got to do some Jack Girard research. I can see his face, you know, he's kind of a, well, in any case, yeah. We got to track some more information down on that. Cora, thank you very much. We'll be back. It's 46 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the latest alerts from Tampa right after this.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the files of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
You tell him, Leonard. I'll take that from a Canadian any day. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, Mitt Romney, by the way, is officially the nominee. He has officially won the nomination. Shana, which state pushed him over? Did you see it? Or were you watching? Did you catch it? It might have been Michigan. That would be fitting. You know, it's where he was born and grown up, and nobody asked for his birth certificate. So, but who knows? Yeah. By the way, interesting story. Remember those miners who were lined up behind Romney a couple of days ago? And I was watching this with Louise on TV, and they were talking, you know, and Romney was talking about, you know, we need coal, and you guys are the salt of the earth and all that kind of stuff. And I was thinking, you know, those guys have been totally suckered. You know, how can you know, miners who, if they're not union miners, they certainly should be, and they know it as well as you and I don't. How can they be standing behind Mitt Romney and be a prop for him? Well, the story is out. Stephen Lacey from Climate Progress over at the Center for American Progress. Miners say they were forced to attend Romney campaign event without pay. We knew what would happen. In other words, not only did they have to show up, or they would lose their job, but that they didn't get paid either. Politico says it's Jersey. What is? Oh, I'm sorry. It was Jersey. Yeah, okay, thank you. And so the miners who showed up, which has nothing to do with Jersey. Hang on. The miners who showed up, they had to forego pay. This is according to accounts from multiple coal miners who sent anonymous letters to a local radio station criticizing Murray Energy. This is who they worked for allegedly requiring all workers to take the day off, forego pay, and attend a Romney campaign event. Just for the record, if we did not go, we knew what would happen, wrote one miner. It was mandatory. It was forced. These are words that the miners used. Our managers communicated to our workforce that the attendance at the Romney event was mandatory, but no one was forced to attend. Yeah, nobody put a gun in their back, but hey, you want to keep your job? Amazing. Amazing. I mean, it's just, stuff like this, it just doesn't go away. Doesn't get better than that. Okay, so New Jersey was the state that pushed Romney over the top. Thank you, Shano. That's very interesting. So we know about that as well. And Joe in St. Charles, Missouri. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Good to see you back.
Thank you.
To watch the people that came out to do the demonstrating at the GOP convention, it was very good to see them out there. It doesn't matter how many people were there or not, but to hear them demonstrate and to say this is what $50 million looks like, and they could only say it to the police that were there, and boy, did the police look pretty with all their equipment. The horses looked like armored tanks.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous.
Well, at least so far in Tampa, the police have been behaving themselves quite reasonably.
Oh, no, it's not the police. They're getting paid to do that. And I know their jobs probably are only as secure as these things last, long as these things last.
Yeah.
And they probably realize that themselves, you know.
Yeah.
And the sad part is it would be nice if they could get a good pension and like, you know, things used to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically, I'll leave it at that. But the lady from Wisconsin that mentioned the websites that you look for, I don't think it's the information that you get your information for your news. I think it's the information people need to know about the several websites and the several magazines that I keep trying to write down on little pieces of paper.
Yeah.
It would be nice to be able to.
I'll tell you some of my favorites. There's Op-Ed News, there's BuzzFlash, there's truthout.org, there's commondreams.org, there's thinkprogress.org, there's talkingpointsmemo.com, there's... Actually, let me look at my own screen here. I've got democraticunderground.com, dailycos.com, mediamatters.org, crooksandliars.com, POL, what
nice
is that? PolitiFact or something? No, it's politico.com. I occasionally read that. I mean,
Politico, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I've been keeping track of intrade.com just because it's interesting to see the where you can bet on who's going to win. They're still predicting that Obama's going to win. And also alternet.org. I occasionally read the Huffington Post. I'm reading the Huffington Post less and less and less. You know, the corporate influence is becoming pretty obvious. And the Financial Times. I read the Financial Times every day. I've done that for probably a third of my adult life. And I very, very often find, because that's, you know, the rich people talking to the rich people. It's you get a fascinating perspective there.
I finally got a chance to talk to somebody who I've been wanting to talk to for a long time over the phone. I appreciate it. And if I could talk to your other counterpart, Mrs. Goodman, just once, I think it would make my life.
Okay, well, you'll have to take that up with her. It's a separate show. But thanks a lot for the call, Joe. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Mark in North Wable, New Hampshire. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today? Just a minute till the end of the show here.
Tom, thanks for taking my call. The president promised to reveal the names of the people who had hidden accounts overseas that they weren't paying taxes on, and I haven't heard a thing about it. Nothing. Not from the IRS. Nothing. If you or I get caught doing something like that.
Are you sure of that? Because my recollection was that in 2009, there was an amnesty program where if you came forward and admitted to the IRS that you had been tax cheating using foreign accounts, you would pay the taxes, you would pay a small fine, but you wouldn't go to jail. But the IRS would know your name, but nobody else. And that, I believe, is why Mitt Romney is not releasing his 2009 tax reform reports, because I think, frankly, he was cheating. But I don't recall the president saying he was going to reveal everybody's name. I may be wrong on this, Mark, but I just don't know. But that I do know about, and that I think is why he's not letting people go on. Anyhow, the RNC convention is underway. We'll bring you all the news tomorrow, as well as a great guest live from the convention hall in Tampa, Florida, plus the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. It ain't a spectator sport. Get active. Get out there. Occupy something. Tag. You're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.